From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Congress and the Syria debate. The president takes his case to Russia. Rosh Hashanah greetings from Iran and Diana Nyad's epic swim. Secretary of State John Kerry made the case for military action against Syria over the use of chemical weapons at the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee hearing on Tuesday.
When the United States of America and the world say never again, we don't mean sometimes, we don't mean somewhere. Never means never.
But all week long, town hall meetings rang with don't do it cries from skeptical, war-weary citizens. Here, one man among many confronting Senator John McCain in Tucson.
This is the politics of distraction. This is 10 years now. We are war-weary. You talked about Iraq. We went into Iraq. Iraq is as big a mess now as it was back then.
And far from the Syria debate, 64-year-old Diana Nyad finally made her epic swim from Cuba to Florida. She staggered from the water with advice for a welcoming crowd on the beach.
We should never, ever give up.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, Susan Davis of USA Today, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will Congress get it right on Syria? How are you weighing the arguments? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Indira Lakshmanan joins us from Washington, senior correspondent for Bloomberg News, covering foreign policy. Indira, great to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter. A little action there this week for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, at the studios today of Dartmouth College, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Indira, and Susan.
Let's go right into the fray of this debate. Here was John Kerry, Secretary of State, former young war protester, on Tuesday making one case for a strike on Syria.
It's not a question of what will happen if we don't do it. It's a certainty. Are you going to be comfortable if Assad, as a result of the United States not doing anything, then gasses his people yet again, and the world says, why didn't the United States act? History is full of opportunity, of moments where someone didn't stand up and act when it made a difference.
The Secretary of State passionate this week, but there was passion on the hustings as well. John McCain, again, in town hall, getting all kinds of pushback. Here was another town hall meeting of McCain's in Phoenix. You'll hear McCain first, then the audience.
We will respect everyone's view, and if you wait
till... You don't respect our view. We didn't send you to get war for us. We sent you to stop the war.
Again and again, that coming back, and public opinion polls not showing a whole lot of support for going in, but a big push from the Obama administration, Susan Davis, at week's end. Well, I want to get inside these arguments and the facts on the ground, but at week's end, where do you think this stands?
I think it's very unclear. I do get the sense, talking both on the House and Senate sides, that it's certainly not a sure thing that it's going to pass Congress, particularly in the U.S. House, where I don't think we've seen a lot of movement, particularly among House Republicans, towards the president's position, despite the fact that House Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor came out early in support, in strong support of voting for this resolution, as did Nancy Pelosi and her number two, Steny Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland. And normally, when you have sort of that type of consensus in the top of leadership, oftentimes the rank and file get in line. In this circumstance, we're not really seeing that. I think that even among Democrats, a lot of anti-war liberals, a lot of overall general war weariness, a lot of skepticism about what the long-term goal of this mission is. And among Republicans, you have, I think, a deep-rooted mistrust of the Obama administration, that they don't understand the purpose of the mission. And the administration has a long way to go to convince these members if they want this to pass the House. In the Senate, the general thinking, although I don't think it's a sure bet there either, particularly because this is likely to face multiple 60-vote thresholds, not even just a simple 50-vote
majority.
A filibuster level. I'm not entirely sure they have the votes there yet either. We've had members in and out of Congress all week, but I think when they come in the early part of next week, when they have the first chance to have closed-door meetings together, I think we're going to get a much stronger sense of which way this is going. But right now, it does not look great for the administration.
Could go either way. Let's take it back to facts on the ground as well as they are known. Indira Lakshmanan, I mean, we still have, here's President Obama at the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg, and Russia's Putin still drawing the very facts into question, saying, you don't know who did this. You can't say Assad did this. What about that, Indira, at this point? I mean, Americans remember going to war on assertions that turned out to be wrong in the past. On the other hand, a lot of dead, a lot of photographs here. Is it perfectly clear what happened and who did it?
Well, I guess that depends on whose intelligence you believe. The Obama administration has made a case, and they have publicly released some intelligence in a declassified report. Obviously, members of Congress and the oversight committees have access to more than we have access to. But they have made the case that only the regime had access to chemical weapons, and that all of the places where the chemical weapons were launched were only into rebel-held areas. You allude to Vladimir Putin's dispute of this, and just today, he essentially made the case that the rebels had launched this chemical attack as a provocation. So the argument would be they launched it against themselves or against civilians in their own area as a provocation to try to force America's hand. So it depends on who you believe. Now, what's interesting about this, you make a reference to faulty intelligence that led us into the Iraq War. And you'll remember very clearly from 2004, John Kerry, then candidate for president, and how much he regretted and publicly talked about his regret over voting to authorize the Iraq War on what he felt was, you know, that he had been led down this path of faulty intelligence. So it's striking to see him in the hot seat now being the administration's chief spokesman for a military strike. And all of those people close to him have said again and again that there's no way he would be making this case if he didn't feel that the intelligence was rock solid.
And a lot of concern, obviously, in both houses over if the U.S. does go in, what then? Here yesterday is New Mexico Democratic Senator Tom Udall, who's saying he's not going with this. He's talking to Steve Inskeep of NPR, explaining his concerns over intervention in Syria.
Going to war is very unpredictable. We're getting ourselves into a volatile situation. We can say that we're only going in on a bombing campaign. We don't know what's going to happen. We could see Russia react in a way that we don't expect. Iran could react. And the leader of this country could end up striking out with chemical weapons beyond his borders.
That would be Assad striking out, Syria striking out with chemical weapons beyond his borders. Jack Beatty, look with us for a moment at this sort of conflicting mission impulse or parameters emerging here. On the one hand, we have the administration and the Senate resolution that passed the Foreign Relations Committee, limiting this to 60 days and maybe another 30 and kind of tight parameters about it. And the administration saying that's all they want is something tightly contained. But then you've got John McCain and Lindsey Graham who go to the White House and come out and say, we're very glad here that we see more coming up on the rails. It's going to push back to change the actual equation of power in Syria, maybe even bring on the end of the Assad regime. And John McCain getting language that could support that into the Senate wording on this as well. What about this conflict that seems right in front of us and unresolved, even as we head toward a vote, Jack, on what's really intended here?
Yes, and every day we hear that the target suite gets longer. The New York Times today reports because of the shifting around of weapon systems and the like, the Pentagon is expanding the number of places that they want to hit. And, you know, the McCain language says our intervention should, words to the effect, affect the momentum on the ground. Well, that's in a way just stating a fact. The fact is that if it hurts Assad, it helps the rebels. That, in effect, could help change the momentum. On the other hand, General Dempsey said, no, we're not doing enough to change the momentum. So it's a study in ambiguity there and in ambivalence. I think for many Americans, just listening to the congressional testimony, I know that I came out on the one hand. I heard General Dempsey say, we're going to give our briefing on collateral damage. That is the number of civilians possibly killed in private. That's just going to be behind closed doors. Is that because more civilians will be killed by our bombs than were killed by his gas? On the other hand, so I'm going there. I'm thinking, yeah, what's going on? On the other hand, Jerry Conley of Virginia asked Secretary Kerry, what happens Is it likely that Assad will use gas again and again and again if we don't act? And Kerry said the likelihood approaches 100%. Well, that's a horrifying thought.
Of course. I mean, how can he know? And he's making a strong case here. Right. General Dempsey also on the record saying that the U.S. military can't decide the outcome of what's going on in Syria. I mean, in Dera, we feel this tension between these two visions of what this is really about, what Congress is really voting for, what the American people ought to think about, what's really on the table here, something tightly confined and constrained or something that will change the momentum. It makes a difference in how you hit Syria.
Well, there are several points wrapped up in your question there. One is the whole notion of public opinion. And we know, according to the latest polls from the Washington Post and ABC, that 6 out of 10 Americans oppose military strikes on Syria and that 70% of Americans oppose arming the rebels, which was part of the compromise draft Senate resolution that was finally agreed to yesterday. Now, you know, you have the issue where, depending on how you ask the question, at the very best, half of Americans will support it if they think it's a limited strike. Look at the body language of General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, when he was sitting up there on the Hill for hours and hours in front of the Senate and the House today, and it was really striking. He was quiet, and he allowed John Kerry to do the big talking.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the Syria question in Congress, above all, the G20 in St. Petersburg, more NSA news this week, and of course, Diana Nyad makes her big swim from Cuba to Florida. Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today, joins us from Washington, as does Indira Lakshmanan, senior correspondent for Bloomberg News on foreign policy. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Will Congress get it right on Syria? What is right here? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. All kinds of response online. A lot of it against. Leah, Congress needs to listen to its constituents. Stay out of Syria. Lonnie, find another way. War is not the answer. That's something like what the Pope said. Do something, but not militarily. Here's the sound of John McCain. This is when he was after meeting with the president on Monday. He and Lindsey Graham coming out. And John McCain, Arizona senator, saying that he's emphasized the importance of not just a punitive strike or retaliation for chemical weapons use, but intervention that would change the momentum on the ground. Here's McCain.
We emphasized the importance we place to actions that would degrade Bashar Assad's capabilities, upgrade the opposition, and to see the change the momentum on the ground.
So, Susan Davis, which is it here? I mean, a lot of Americans just playing against this, but for people on the fence trying to decide, don't want to buy a pig in a poke here, on Capitol Hill, what do you understand is actually being planned on the back of this intervention? You know, something really confined or something that's really going to change the momentum? Surely those are slightly different. I mean, Indira is right. Both would presumably hurt Assad. But what you do, how you do it, how long you do it, how deep you go, how much you throw at it makes a difference, Susan.
Completely. And I think that the case that the administration made in John Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and Chairman Dempsey was that this is a – Kerry repeatedly said this is not war. This is not another war. This is a singular response to the use of chemical weapons.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting is the way that Dempsey repeatedly characterized the military mission was simply to, I believe the term he kept using was deter and degrade. Not to, it's not regime change. It's not to take Assad out. It is not to fundamentally change what's happening on the ground. And I think that there, McCain obviously being the most vocal proponent of saying, well, that's not enough. I mean, there is a component of Republicans that are saying if we're going to engage, then we should do so with a broader end goal than just limited military airstrikes that Syria has now been well warned that may occur. I just think, and Tom Udall clip mm-hmm. that you played earlier, I think really encapsulated what a strong view of Congress is that there is zero appetite for longer term engagement without a clear mission and without a I think the key point here is that what I hear repeatedly from members of Congress is they do not think the case has been made that the national security interests of the United States are are threatened right now. And until they can convince more members of that argument, I think that they're going to have a very difficult time making the case to Congress.
Deter and degrade. Indira, that word degrade can be taken in a lot of directions. I mean, people first thought Tomahawk missiles. Now they're reporting today, New York Times and others, that we're going to have all kinds of bombers in here, B-52s, B-1s out of Qatar, maybe even stealth bombers out of Missouri. You know, we could go long and hard, and deep French maybe in there as well. Degrade and regime change can get pretty close to one another if you want them to, Indira.
Right. I mean, the thing is, if the United States wanted to do regime change, there are those who would argue they should have taken action 2.5 years ago when this all began and when they first started saying that Assad needed to leave. The problem is that right now Obama's trying to thread this needle, and he's trying to satisfy both poles in Congress, those who want to limit U.S. intervention as tightly as possible, which seems to be what the administration itself wants to do, limit the intervention, and the other pole who really think we need to step up the aid to the rebels, and that's what that compromise draft Senate Foreign Relations Resolution was about. But I would really urge listeners to read a Washington Post op-ed today called A War the Pentagon Doesn't Want by a man who is a retired Army Major General and former commandant of the U.S. War College, Robert Scales. Mm. He makes an incredibly, stunningly harsh and blunt case that the uniformed military is totally against any action in military in Syria. And he talks about Dempsey's body language and how the opinions of most serving military leaders are that supposedly, in his words, this path to war violates every principle of war, including the element of surprise, achieving mass, and having a clearly defined and obtainable objective. And it all comes down to that. What is your objective? Is your objective to oust Assad, or is your objective to respond specifically to chemical weapons? And if you can't get the votes without, you know, satisfying those who also want you to oust Assad, then it puts you in a pretty pickle there. And, you know, it is really hard. Susan has alluded to this vote counting and, you know, the nose counting on the Hill. And either way, the administration needs 217 votes in the House and 60 votes in the Senate to be able to get this through. And I wouldn't bet my paycheck at this point. I mean, I think it's probably likely they'll end up pulling it through, but I wouldn't bet my paycheck. And we heard Tony Blinken on NPR this morning, the deputy national security advisor, saying the president doesn't want to go without Congress. But neither is that an ironclad promise that the president won't go without Congress.
Let's hear a couple of voices on that. Here's Vladimir Putin. This was today at the G20 summit in St. Petersburg. We're not going to agree.
We listen to each other. We understand arguments. We do not agree with those arguments, but still we can hear them.
President Obama at the same conference in St. Petersburg not long ago saying, well, the U.S. is ready to go without the U.N.
It is my view, and a view that was shared by a number of people in the room, that given Security Council paralysis on this issue, if we are serious about upholding a ban on chemical weapons use, then an international response is required, and that will not come through Security Council action.
President Obama in St. Petersburg, not through the Security Council, maybe not even through Congress. Jack Beatty, this administration has appeared quite willing so far, at least from outside, to straddle this question about, is this a punitive response to chemical weapons use, or is this to get Assad? That's what John McCain wants. That's what Lindsey Graham wants. They may need those votes to get this through, but if you straddle at the beginning, what happens, Jack?
Yes. In the foreground, it could cost votes in the House of liberal Democrats who point to that and say, look, there's the writing on the wall. That's what these people want. And then mission creep is just built into something like this. And the administration's statement, well, it'll be limited, leaves out the vote that the Syrians have. They'll do something, we'll do something, and on it'll go. There's no possibility that they can commit themselves to, you know, date certain and it stops. In fact, the question that came up, what happens on the 91st day? Say we go for 90 days and on this congressional resolution. What happens on day 91 if Assad goes back to gas? Do we strike again? Do we come to Congress? All that is up in the air. I thought this morning, by the way, that Tony Blinken made a little bit of news on NPR when he did say, he said the president has the authority to act, but it's neither his desire nor his intention to use that authority absent congressional backing. And the Times today reports that White House people say it's all but unthinkable that the president would go to war without congressional approval. That, I think, is a new wrinkle on this, because Secretary Kerry, understandably, given his position, was shrouding that in ambiguity. Now I think it's clearer.
I mean, there may be other responses to that. A big beefing up of support to rebels. We'll look at that. I want to get to our callers. Doug in Buffalo, New York. Doug, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Almost as an act of desperation, on Friday I wrote to my congressional delegation in New York saying that I was opposed to any military intervention by the United States alone. I see this as a regional issue, something for the surrounding Arab states to get together to, force a ceasefire, separate the various sides, and start to bring civil society.
Yeah, Doug, I get that, but what if that's dreaming? What if they're never going to do that? Does that change your position or not?
No, it does not. This is not our fight.
Doug, we've got it. I want to keep moving here. We've got so many callers. Hannah in Lewisburg, Kentucky. You're on, Hannah.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think the fact that we're in this mess of voting just shows a lack of leadership by our president and even our society. You know, if we had to take a vote on slavery or Hitler or some of the equal opportunity in school or working, we probably still would have slavery, or we could be Heil Hitler. It's just crazy to think that we need to have a vote on morality. I think Obama should have seen what happened, the gassing, and taken immediate action and not delayed it by letting so many people put their opinion in that we never do anything.
But yeah, he's commander in chief, but this is a president who was very upset back when he was a senator over, you know, the idea of executive military action without congressional sign off, and a secretary of state as well. But this leadership question is interesting, Hannah. I appreciate your call. And one more, Marfa, Texas. Joe, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that everybody should take a step back and look at history. The major strategic interest in the Middle East is Israel. If you eliminate Syria, you increase the aspect of protecting Israel. And, you know, this is still a eliminating Syria.
What do you mean eliminating Syria? You mean taking a change of government?
Getting boots on the ground. I think this is going to happen. Look, the military never wants to go to war. But if Syria, Assad falls, you've eliminated the Russian influence forever. It's the last battle of war.
Don't count on that, but okay.
And Iran will not have a strategic position anymore in the middle of the Middle East. So Hezbollah goes, Israel is protected. Let's not be naive. I voted for Obama. I am a Northeast liberal, but if my family's from Poland, we know all about the Russians and this kind of tyranny. You've got to be kidding if you don't think there's going to be an airstrike for strategic military interests. And I'll leave you with one question.
Yeah.
Why didn't we intervene in Iraq when Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Iran for years against the Kurds?
Yeah, well, that's a complicated issue in itself. But Joe, in Marfa, Texas, I appreciate your call. We're looking at all these issues in the week in the news, and Syria and Congress right in the middle of it all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Oh, boy. Susan, let me come in here. Let's pick up. It's high holidays for the American Jewish community, and of course in Israel as well. We've got this interesting thing of Iran's foreign minister and president sending Rosh Hashanah greetings out via Twitter to the world. What about the Israel factor in this whole debate over what to do about Syria? Is it a big factor on Capitol Hill right now, or
it
not?
Is a big,
How
it
so?
It is a big factor, certainly in the sense that AIPAC, which is an Israeli lobby has come out strongly in favor of these airstrikes. I think that, and have said that over the course of the next week, as an organization, they're going to step up their lobbying efforts to members of Congress to make the case that they should support the president on this. And I don't think you can underestimate that they're a tremendously powerful lobbying influence in Washington. They have a lot of really strong relationships with lawmakers in both parties. And I think that they are going to be a critical, if behind the scenes, effort in terms of getting this passed. Although one thing I think is striking, both from your callers that we've heard so far and the anecdotal things that I've heard from congressional offices, is that there is unambiguous opposition among constituents to vote for this. And I think you have to keep that in mind when you're asking, particularly House members. Senators do represent larger constituencies. The Senate traditionally has a broader role in foreign policy in terms of approving treaties. It's more of an institutional familiarity. Within the House, I mean, I've talked to congressional offices that have said they've gotten 650 phone calls and only two are in support.
Wow.
I had a senior aide tell me yesterday that there is not a congressional district in this country that has a majority of support for this action. I mean, this is going to be an incredibly difficult vote in the House. And I think what you're hearing from your callers is exactly what members of Congress are hearing as they've been home while this debate's been happening. And this is what they're hearing and coming back and taking that vote. And I think that it highlights how difficult this is going to be for them.
Indira, I'm monitoring all the electronic inputs here, and there are many from our listeners all over the place. And one theme that does come up, though, is the U.S. credibility issue. And if it doesn't act here, it's effectively a green light to Iran on its nuclear program, to North Korea on its nuclear program. What about that assertion, Indira?
That's exactly what I wanted to bring up. And that's one of the cases that John Kerry, who's made such an interesting career arc, if we sort of step back and take a long view. He first testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when he was a decorated war veteran and anti-Vietnam War protester in 1971. And now he's back before that same committee as the chief spokesman salesman for a Syrian strike. Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting and ironic twist. Although, again, his aides and close friends say, well, he was arguing his conscience then and he's arguing his conscience now. But you make an excellent point, and John Kerry has made this point, that at this point, once we've taken a moral, principled stand, if we say that the real problem is the breaking of an international norm against the use of chemical weapons, then it's very hard to see how we don't go, how we don't do something, regardless of what Congress says, from the point of view of the international community. And the difficulty is that I think Obama has put himself between that proverbial rock and a hard place. Because on the one hand, he wants American public buy-in, he wants congressional buy-in. But if he doesn't get that and he doesn't act, he certainly makes the United States look like a weak power. And I do have to say that I think your caller, Joe from Texas, mm-hmm. had an interesting and long view of history. And on the one hand, I want to commend him for pointing out that if we care so much about chemical weapons, Saddam Hussein used them not only against his own people, the Kurdish people. So that would be a sort of parallel case, Assad using them against his own people. But he also used them against a foreign power, against Iran, in the Iran-Iraq war. And we did not act against him in either of those cases. And there are people who say, well, you know, we have a different president now. We want to act because we think this is wrong. But there are also people who see it in the anti-war crowd as kind of a proxy for our war against Iran, the fact that Iran and Hezbollah, you know, have been allied with Syria, have been supporting Syria. So there is a whole question about what are our motivations and, you know, what are we going to accomplish, by doing something.
Yeah, Indira, please stand by. Susan Davis. Jack, what an irony. If this president, the Nobel Peace Prize winning constitutional law scholar, asks for a vote from Congress, doesn't get the authorization and would go in anyway. Wow, what a world we're in. We'll see. You say the sound is leaning the other way today, Jack. We'll hit this a little more and then we'll move on. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, well, the huge wildfire in Yosemite on its way to being tamed. By Wednesday, Rim Fire Command Team spokesman Mark Healy said that fire was 80% contained.
We're at 80% containment on the fire. The acres burned did not increase during the day. We are still at 235,841 acres burned.
Blaming it now on a hunter's fire, but it was ready to go. Kidnapper and rapist Ariel Castro found hanged in his cell on Tuesday, just 1 month into his 1,000-year-plus prison term. Angel Arroyo, a friend of the family of Castro victim Gina De Jesus, had this to say.
For so long, he held these girls captives, and only 4 months, he committed suicide, and they made a deal so he can spend the rest of his life in jail. He couldn't even last 10 years as long as he held these girls.
And Sir David Frost, the veteran British broadcaster, died this weekend at 74. He was best known for his historic interviews with former President Richard Nixon, 1977.
So what, in a sense, you're saying is that there are certain situations where the president can decide that it's in the best interest of the nation or something and do something illegal?
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
A word from Richard Nixon, maybe to Barack Obama there. We'll see. A week in the news. We're on it with Indira Lakshmanan of Bloomberg News, Susan Davis of USA Today, Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Just a little more on Syria. It is so big. I mean, this question, there was this really interesting moment. The president on his way to St. Petersburg here talking in Stockholm on Wednesday saying, I didn't set the red line.
I didn't set a red line. The world set a red line. The world set a red line when governments representing 98% of the world's population said the use of chemical weapons are abhorrent.
Oh, well. He didn't set the red line. And there was more. Indira, he said, my credibility is not on the line. He said the international community's credibility is on the line. And America and Congress's credibility is on the line. Really, Indira?
Well, I want to make one point. If we want to talk about what actual international law says, he says, I didn't set this red line. International law and norms did. In fact, the Geneva Convention signed in 1925 and the larger Chemical Weapons Convention, which was signed only a couple decades ago, they do not have enforcement mechanisms. So anyone who studies international law, and I'm sure the president knows this very well himself, although much of the world signed on to those conventions, they do not provide any method for any member of the world community acting against a member who uses chemical weapons in contravention of that convention unless there's a UN Security Council resolution authorizing that use of force. So you could argue again that when chemical weapons have been used in the past, like by Saddam Hussein, that there was no method really for taking retribution against a state who did that. As far as credibility goes, you know, he has a big problem here because it's true. America's credibility is on the line because we've spoken up. You can say the world's credibility to its responsibility to protect the defenseless, women and children who were killed in this gas attack, and, you know, take a larger stand so that we don't have another Bosnia, Rwanda, etc. That's on the line. But also, how can he act once he's given Congress the power? If Congress doesn't support him, then it almost becomes an impeachable offense, one could argue. So it's a really difficult situation.
And people grabbing very quickly for impeachable offenses lately. Jack, what about this credibility issue for the country, for this president? And I mean, I think we can't leave George W. Bush out of this equation. Iraq comes up again and again. You hear it in these town hall meetings. President Obama's clearly got himself in a pickle here. But reading Timothy Egan in the Times today, time should not soften what President George W. Bush and his apologists did in an 8-year war costing the U.S. more than $1 trillion, 4,400 American soldiers dead, and still muddying the debate, he says, over what to do in the face now of a state-sanctioned mass killer. All kinds of credibility issues here, Jack.
Yes, and, you know, you can argue that that is a good thing, that it means that presidents, that it limits the possibility of optional wars, and that the country will only fight in clear, unambiguous cases of self-defense. And some people looking at post-war history would say, well, my gosh, Vietnam wouldn't have happened. We wouldn't have done Iraq. That's a good thing. And the presidency, the imperial presidency that grew up apace with these optional wars, that will be cut down a deal. That
you know, from the point of view, if you don't want foreign intervention, that may be a good thing. On the other hand, it does mean the president simply can't act even in these humanitarian ways, which seem to have a strong moral case. The idea of just the sight of all those children in their bloodless white shrouds. I mean, one wants anything that could stop that. One thinks should be done. And yet, if the credibility bequeathed him by the Iraq fiasco is such that he can't act, then that horror just happens, and no one is there to stop it.
And on we go, Meredith in Barrie, Vermont. Meredith, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to just address the players and the price tag. And you just referenced something that I haven't heard anybody else mention, which is that our president is a Nobel Peace Prize winner, and yet is so quick to move to this. And again, the Secretary of State is a former war protester. John McCain, who was all over this Syria intervention, was a presidential candidate, who then picked Sarah Palin as his running mate.
But Meredith, the president would say he's not quick to this, that he has been over backwards too much, McCain would say, to stay out of Syria.
Let me just say this.
Mm-hmm.
He won't talk to Vladimir Putin, who may be one of the people who could help. I don't see any efforts toward any kind of negotiated settlement in this. And what I wonder about is nobody's talking about the price tag. We've already apparently moved a carrier group into the region. What is that costing? What is it going to cost for an intervention? And we don't know what might happen after our limited, quote-unquote, strike.
Yeah.
And we have a government that we have a debt ceiling that needs to be raised and a budget. We can see the government shutting down because Congress won't pass a budget or raise
the debt. Meredith, let us look at both of those. Of course, these destroyers in the Mediterranean, a carrier group now in the Red Sea within range, we're told. Bombers on standby, apparently. Let's just take the cost issue. Susan Davis, Secretary of Defense Hagel, told lawmakers Wednesday that this operation will cost in the tens of millions of dollars, which sounds like chump change when you get into these military. Is that like, cakewalk, $100 million and out, the pre-Iraq talk?
When you're talking about tens of millions of dollars in a defense budget that's about $500 billion every year, it is not a substantial financial cost to the U.S.
But does anybody believe it?
Yes and no. I think that in the context of funding, I do think that, and the caller brings up a very good point about how this, what this means for the other debates that are happening in Congress right now. And what you do hear, particularly from Buck McKeon, who's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, for example, is saying that there may be able to get more support among Republicans for this resolution if the Obama administration agrees to change what's been known as the sequester, the across-the-board spending cuts that are underway for the Pentagon that have been affecting defense programs. I think their concern is more about the cuts that are existing because of separate budget decisions than they are about what the exact cost of this mission is, although you could argue that the two are very much related in terms of what we spend on our defense operations each year. I think she raised a good point that I think is worth making and having your listeners keep in context is, win or lose, this is not going to help President Obama's relationship with Congress. Whether this passes Congress or fails Congress, I think he's exerted a tremendous amount of political capital in order to get this done. If it does get done, I think the political capital he's exerted is going to leave the tank pretty low in the coming weeks when the administration has to figure out how to deal with Congress on how to fund the government, how to raise the debt ceiling, how to deal with the sequester.
Yeah.
And it entrenches a lot of bitterness between the two ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And I also think even and if he doesn't, if it fails and he bombs anyway, as Indira already mentioned, I think that will inflame the opposition, particularly in the House Republican Conference towards the president, that is going to make the negotiations over these other more pressing domestic issues much more difficult. And it looks as far as we can see the remainder of the legislative year, it looks like it's going to be a very combative 2-4 months between Congress and the president.
But, I mean, how weird this chemistry gets, that we might, be unleashing missiles on Syria so that an entirely different debate back in Washington doesn't get bogged down. And the president, I'm looking at an AP headline just out of Russia, out of St. Petersburg, the president of the United States refusing to say what he would do if Congress doesn't approve Syria strikes, leaving that strike without approval option open. Dennis in Newport, Rhode Island. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. Somebody said earlier that if we don't bomb, we're going to be perceived as weak as a nation. Mm-hmm. I would like to suggest that the democratic process, going to Congress, polling the people, finding out what they want, isn't that a way of showing how strong we are as a nation, following our type of government and what we're trying to show to the rest of the world?
Yeah, well, let's pick it up. Indira, Peggy Noonan today saying, no, we shouldn't do it. And we won't look weaker because kind of along these lines. You know, we sat back, we considered it. We, if we just democratically decide it's not worth our trouble, we're fine with that. Of course, she may be building a kind of subtle voice case there that against the president's leadership capacity. But what do you think? She thinks that if she says that if the U.S. doesn't hit Syria, Iran and North Korea won't think it's a green light to do anything they like. They'll think, well, they're still got their eye on the big game. That's us. We better be careful.
Well, there's certainly an argument to be made that by going through this whole process, the president is modeling for the rest of the world how a constitutional democracy works and seeking the approval of the people and the elected members and not acting alone, even though technically under the War Powers Act, he could act alone. But I think whether you perceive that that would make us look weak or strong really depends on your geopolitical view and whether you think we need to act and draw a red line against the use of banned weapons of mass destruction. I want to pick up on another caller who made a really interesting point about the risks. And that is one thing. You know, we're talking about the risks of not acting. Also, what are the risks of acting? We can't predict how our opponent is going to react. We don't know how Syria, whether Assad would unleash more chemical weapons, whether this would exacerbate the conflict. We don't know whether Hezbollah, the militant group that supports him, might try to strike Israel or Jordan or other targets, Lebanon. Just this morning, there was an announcement put out that the U.S. is drawing down mandatorily its non-essential diplomats from Beirut, from Lebanon, because of concerns about the Syria issue. The Wall Street Journal reported that there are intercepts showing that Iran is talking about targeting the U.S. embassy and U.S. targets in Iraq if an attack happens. And Russia just today at the G20 said, Putin himself said, if the U.S. goes forward with a strike on Syria, we will continue to support Syria with military supplies. So, you know, it raises the other question. The administration wants diplomacy, but is diplomacy dead at this point if we do a strike? I don't know the answer to that.
Molly writes to us, war is a very unpredictable thing. War always lasts longer, costs more than predicted. I don't think, she writes, the Syrians need our help in picking their dictator. I mean, there's just the sense of kind of jaundiced American sense about what's going on in this region and U.S. influence there. David in Hartford, Connecticut. You're on, David.
I think this entire nation for the last decade or 12 years since 9/11 has been operating out of fear. We have forgotten that the only thing to fear is fear itself, whether it's the massive overstretch of the NSA or these ridiculous wars we've been fighting and for what. You know, everything we do, we're reactive. But we do not have a unified policy that comes from a rational assessment of real fact.
David, I don't know when we're ever going to get that in a democracy, absolutely unified policy. Fear itself? Well, people might fear deep pits of war. They might fear NSA surveillance. There is a lot on the table for everybody to consider. Boy, not a lot of time, but I want to turn just briefly to a couple of other points. Indira, on the NSA front, now it appears that they've broken encryption of all kinds of U.S. internet traffic. These Edward Snowden leaks just keep coming. It feels like we're going to have a headline a week for the next year. I don't know, but maybe at this point everybody feels naked and that's just the way it is.
They keep coming, and they also are having all sorts of ripple effects that we haven't talked about. I mean, the Brazilians have canceled what was essentially meant to be a state visit.
She's not coming at all now.
The latest thing we've heard is that they're they're canceling the meetings because they're so angry about the Brazilian president being monitored.
Telephone or internet is
right. So I mean, we don't know. You know, maybe ultimately they'll come to some resolution. Hopefully, they will. Mm-hmm. But certainly they've expressed their anger about that. So, you know, we see that it's affecting us internationally as well as domestically.
Susan Davis, we've got Bill Clinton speaking out this week for Obamacare. The president calls Clinton his secretary of explanation. is Congress listening? Do you think it matters these days if Bill Clinton speaks up on that?
I do. I think, I mean, certainly there is certainly a constituency that Bill Clinton has that can speak to that I think that Obama has been alienated from, particularly in certain states. And Clinton is a very good messenger, as he proved at the DNC when he gave his speech there and how well received that was. And I think he's a very valuable ally to Obama in this. I do think, especially because one of the issues coming up immediately is this, what we call the CR, which funds the government. And there's this ongoing effort by Republicans to try and defund some elements of the law in that fight as open enrollment starts for the healthcare law on October 1st. So it's very good timing to have Bill Clinton out there trying to make a case because there is still very strong opposition to the law and to funding it.
Jack, on the hang in there front, we have this wonderful image of 64-year-old Diana Nyad coming up out of the sea, all jellyfish stung and swollen, and still at 64 swimming that amazing length from Havana right there to Florida and saying, never give up. I mean, are you out swimming laps on the Connecticut River up behind the house up there, Jack? Get in shape for your big swim.
I'm going to take my dip. You know, it really is something. And the thing I resent is everyone keeps saying, my gosh, she's 64 years old. Wait a minute. She's a young woman.
Absolutely. I mean, look at her, 34-year-olds. How many swims have you taken from Havana to the beach in Florida? It really is uplifting, and there is something absolutely true in her advice. Never give up. Hang in there. Keep at it for us all. A really good conversation on a week of the most kind of disconcerting and difficult questions that a country can face. I want to thank all three of you. Susan Davis with USA Today, Chief Congressional Reporter there. Susan, so great to have you. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Indira Lakshmanan, senior correspondent at Bloomberg News on foreign policy. You're great, Indira. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack, have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.